In the matter of Rodriguez versus Shelbourne Spring, may we please have appearances of counsel?
Your Honor, Benjamin Clark defers to Patrick Cole and Giblin for defending third party plaintiff SIR Electric LLC. With me at counsel table is Rick Hazley of my firm.
Good afternoon, Mr. Justice and Associate Justice Catherine DeMaro from Wilson Elser on behalf of Hartford Underwriters Insurance.
Good afternoon and welcome, counsel. Mr. Clark.
Mr. Chief Justice, honorable justices, may it please the court. Good afternoon. If I may, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
We'll have you back, perhaps for a little less.
It's always an awe-inspiring sight to see the breadth and difficulty of the issues that the court has to deal with on a morning and afternoon. And I'm hoping that I can make this one the easy case on the docket today, because the pivotal issue and the dispositive issue, I would say, can be framed in the as an unchallenging true-false question. And the question goes, true or false? Under New Jersey law, a workers' compensation carrier has an obligation to defend its insured employers against claims of bodily injury brought by an injured employee in the Superior Court of New Jersey. For a very long time, longer than I've been practicing, which is itself a long time, the answer to that question has been a clear and unequivocal true. And but for the setbacks that my client and I have suffered on our way to this court, I would stand here and confidently assert that the answer to that question is still true. But the fact is that the lower courts have both answered the question false. I submit in derogation of longstanding precedent and established law and the public policy of this New Jersey. SIR, which is a small solar installation panel, solar panel installation concern, comes to this court asking it to reaffirm that under New Jersey law, workers' compensation carriers still have an obligation to defend insured employers against claims of negligence and gross negligence filed in the Superior Court or misfiled in the Superior Court of New Jersey. And we think that answer is not only consistent with existing law, but mandated by the public policy of the workers' compensation laws, as this court has had occasion on numerous cases to articulate it. And I don't want to spend my time belaboring the obvious, but I do think at the outset, I need to emphasize something that nobody in this courtroom could reasonably dispute, which is that the complaint that Dionisio Rodriguez, the employee of SIR who suffered an unfortunate workplace accident, does contain claims of negligence and gross negligence against SIR. And the reason I emphasize that is that it was the Hartford's position at the beginning of this case, and you can look at the transcript of the oral argument in the law division, that the complaint did not even set forth claims of negligence, which was a position I took pretty heated exception to, because there it is in black and white. The complaint alleges that SIR has committed negligence, gross negligence, recklessness, and intentional wrongdoing. So over the course of the proceedings, Hartford's position has kind of evolved beyond, well, there are no claims of negligence in the complaint, to something slightly different, and it's on the slightly different ones that they've ultimately carried the day in the appellate division, which is that, well, it's not only claims of negligence, or it's not really claims of negligence. And those are really two different assertions, and I think both of them need to be examined, because they show exactly what has happened wrong below. To say that the complaint does not only include claims of negligence under basic insurance law, the Voorhees case in particular, doesn't matter. It is immaterial. If a complaint asserts covered claims, that there are other claims potentially falling outside the coverage that are also included. Does not matter. And I seldom want to, I don't like reading from cases to a body such as this, but in Voorhees, I think this one really warrants it. It says, to hold otherwise would be to place upon the insured the burden of demonstrating in advance of the underlying litigation which of the competing theories of recovery against it was applicable for purposes of insurance, thereby frustrating one of the basic purposes of such a clause in the insurance contract, protection of the insured from the expenses of litigation. That's 128 NJ at 174. And that is what we are here asking this court to do, because SIR had a contract that should have protected it from the burdens and expenses of litigation, because the complaint alleged, among other things, that it was guilty, that SIR was guilty of negligence and gross negligence. And under case after case, from Danik versus Homer to the present, workers' compensation carriers have been obligated to defend their insureds in cases such as that.
So your adversary seems to say that that's not the case, and that it's actually Rodriguez-Ortiz that represents the radical change in the law, because no case had ever found a duty to defend an employer in a civil lawsuit under Part 1 workers' compensation. So is this just a factual dispute as to how the law existed? Or
I don't... case after case, you can find the issue is litigated of whether the requirements of Laidlaw have been met sufficiently to vault the exclusivity bar. Happens every day in New Jersey. And I think a very important point to make to this court is Laidlaw claims are not some far out aberrational thing. There, you go to any vicinage in New Jersey any day, you will find Laidlaw claims on the docket. It's we have decision after decision talking about it's a high standard. Well, maybe a high standard. It is not difficult to plead one. And in every one of those cases, until my client comes along, the entity that is handling the defense of those claims to prove that it wasn't really a Laidlaw claim, that it was really only a claim of negligence that has to be and should only be compensated in workers' compensation, is the carrier's attorney. I don't know why, because we're dealing with this exclusion that was somehow implemented in 2007, and it's a very meaningful question. What happened from 2007 to today that in the Rodriguez-Ortiz case and this case, suddenly we have insurance companies disclaiming not just coverage, but the duty to defend? I can't tell you what it is, but the fact that there has not been any case in the interim tells me that until now, the insurance industry has recognized that, yes, it may have this post-Delta Plastics exclusion, but that exclusion does not obviate or negate a duty to defend an insured employer against claims of negligence and gross negligence in a complaint, and the plaintiff's bar knows this. And so the plaintiff's bar knows that a claim of simple negligence and gross negligence will not clear the exclusivity bar, but it also knows that it will trigger the duty to defend. And you know, 98% of all civil cases settle. So this is not some arcane or mysterious practice going on. This is nuts and bolts tort litigation in our court system.
So you're saying, Mr. Clark, that these underlying complaints are being pled rather than to follow the laid law factors and talk about substantial certainty and more than a fact of life and beyond what the legislature would have expected, rather than a true laid law pleading, which appears in some complaints, there is an inartful but not so inartful in effect pleading of negligence and gross negligence instead, so that the carrier is in to defend. And the hope is that potentially there's some money from an insurance company. What if the case?
I was with you until you used the phrase true laid low claim, because the fact of the matter is that the laid low standard, substantial certainty plus context, which I would call, I've tried to come up with a name that these are quasi intentional torts. Clear. I mean, my client did not intend for his employee to be injured. There is no meaningful sense of the term intent that says to the contrary.
Let me ask it more simply. I thought what you were saying is that we're not seeing express laid law claims tracking the language of laid law. We're seeing negligence, gross negligence, because that's a sort of a muddy middle ground.
Well, muddy middle ground, I'm with you on that. If we can agree on that, I will do that. But the point
What I'm trying to say is what is the strategy that you say is going on out there in the real world of complaints being filed in order to get some insurance money, since the disclaimer was approved in 2007?
Any laid low complaint that you see will include, drawn up by a competent attorney, will include claims of negligence and gross negligence, because the practicing bar knows that triggers a duty to defend because it is so basic. I've used this example below. It got me nowhere. But imagine a slightly different case, Justice Patterson. An employee steps on an upturned garden rake and breaks his nose, goes to an attorney who says, you know, I think it was negligent of my fellow employee to leave that rake open. He says, you're right, you know, and this attorney, for whatever reason, has either never heard of workers' compensation or has forgotten. Mm-hmm. He said, you're right, we're going to court, we're going to sue the pants off him, files nothing but a negligence complaint. Now, we all know what's going to happen to that complaint. It's going to be tossed on the exclusivity bar, but you still have a lawsuit that is pending in the court. And if you don't answer that lawsuit, guess what? You will have a judgment for pain and suffering and all of those things very quickly. And so the question is, who's supposed to defend that suit? So, now, under our law, the coverage of the workers' compensation policy and the employer's liability policy is supposed to be seamless. Now, if that complaint does not trigger a duty to defend on behalf of the insurance, it's not the seamless coverage. It's the employer, the emperor's new insurance, because it disappears just when the employer needs it.
So can I just interrupt you then? Let's take your hypothetical for a second. Because there's coverage under Part 1, the carrier would have the obligation to defend the personal injury lawsuit, even if it's simply a limited obligation to either move to dismiss for failure to state or transfer the case to the workers' comp division where it might more properly be belong. I agree with you hypothetically that that's the situation. Change the hypothetical. Instead of the employee steps on the upturned rake, the employee loses a finger because the employee is working on equipment that the employer deliberately removed the safety guard on, knowing that it's likely the employee would lose a finger. That's a laid low type claim, right?
It would be so styled, yes.
In that situation, under Part 2, the exclusion would bar coverage. Are you saying that the comp carrier still has an obligation to defend the second hypothetical where the guard was removed, understanding that there'd be no coverage under Part 2, it would be excluded, and it would be an allegation that there was an intentional wrongdoing?
A case in which the insurance company might not have a duty to defend in your circumstance is imaginable. But it is not a case that we have in front of the court today. And with my general respect for the savviness of the practicing bar, I don't think you're ever going to see it. But it's very important to emphasize that you have a disconnect between the Laidlaw standard and the terms of the insurance policies. Laidlaw does, and this case presents a very good example, and why I was agreeing with Justice Patterson about the murkiness is that the trial court, in initially upholding the disclaimer here, said that the nature, the essence of this complaint was that SIR was guilty of gross negligence, vaulting the Laidlaw standard. Now, there's language in the Delta Plastics case. It's not actually language that's beyond future attack that says no way, no how does gross negligence clear the Laidlaw bar. But I'm not here to tell this court that that's never going to be the case. So, it could happen. That is all evolving. And so the standard of liability doesn't dovetail perfectly or even nicely with the standard language in the policy.
The trial judge has to do what this judge did here. Look at the allegations in the complaint and see as to the part one and part two of the policy, what is covered. Clearly, recklessness is covered. Gross negligence is covered. Negligence is covered. That you're saying that the comp carrier has the obligation to defend, move to dismiss for failure to state a claim, or transfer the case to the workers' comp division. Obviously, he filed a claim for workers' comp benefits and got them and may still be getting them. But as to the Laidlaw allegations in the complaint, and they were specific in the complaint, under the exclusion part two, there'd be no duty to defend those, correct?
Well, there we get to an untested question and a very important question. It's a question which is public policy of New Jersey. Can the insurance industry, consistent with this court's Schmidt case, exclude a quasi-intentional Laidlaw claim?
I'm not talking about quasi-Laidlaw claim. I'm talking about a pure Laidlaw claim.
The point I'm trying to make, Justice Fasciale, is that the whole substantial certainty plus context test takes, in any meaningful sense of the word, takes us outside of a true intentional tort. It's not. It's a judicial fiction that's been created quite properly and understandably by this court to expand the ability of injured employees to get away from the exclusivity.
But it's triggered to the intentional wrong exception. It didn't come out of the ether. And if you look at Millison, it was very much tied in with what constitutes an intentional wrong. The traditional sort of 100 years ago scenario was the boss punches the employee in the nose. But Millison reflects a recognition that an intentional wrong can take on in a world involving exposures, et cetera. It was asbestos, obviously, in that case. It can go beyond the most obvious intentional acts. And that's when you look at the pre-Millison law, then to Millison, then the whole series of cases, Laidlaw, Van Dunk, and many others, it comes out of the intentional wrong statutory language. Do you dispute that?
It's a judicial exegesis of that phrase. It's, yes.
You call it a fiction, but my understanding of how this evolved was that it was our court interpreting what it means to be intentional in different settings, and so it's not divorced from that. Would you dispute that Laidlaw finds its origin in statutory language?
I mean, we're not arguing with or taking exception to the substantial certainty plus context case.
I have a question about it, because you were saying that this is a whole different set of cases from intentional. Do you dispute that that Laidlaw and the subsequent cases, and Millicent for that matter, much, much longer ago, are interpretations of that statutory language intentional?
There's no question that it's an expansion upon and interpretation of the phrase intentional wrong in Section 8 of the workers' compensation statute. My point is that if you, and again, it's kind of a well down the road point for me because we don't need to get there. My point is there are claims of negligence and gross negligence in the complaint. Ding, ding, ding. That's the, but
are you,
I'm saying, you, Justice Patterson, that it does not follow that because this court has interpreted the term intentional wrong to mean one thing under Section 8 for vaulting the exclusivity bar, that it necessarily is okay for the insurance industry to say, we're not going to defend those cases.
We're not talking about indemnification, we're talking about defending. But do you, in terms of the enhanced intentional injury exemption that appears in this policy, are you arguing that that does not disclaim or bar coverage for Laidlaw claims? Because what it says is this insurance does not cover any and all intentional wrongs within the exception allowed by NJSA 3415-1, et cetera.
I am not here on an indemnity claim.
Okay.
I'm here on a duty to defend claim.
So position.
And so, it is important for me to note, because that next case is coming, and I will certainly be on the side that says, I don't think the public policy of New Jersey can or does support a disclaimer by those, because if you go to the Schmidt case, is quite clear. It says any claims of bodily injury by an injured employee must be covered either in workers' comp or in court, both. You've got to cover both. That's the price of admission to selling this insurance in New Jersey. Both of those must be covered.
But you're not, in this case, taking the position that disclaimer, which refers specifically to the intentional wrong exception under the statute, is unconscionable.
Oh, I have asserted that to the extent it is being interpreted and used today to disclaim defense obligations, I say it is absolutely against the public policy of New Jersey. And I think that's it couldn't be clearer. What I have said is probably a case for another day, although this body certainly has the power to look at this and look at the Schmidt case, look at the policy and say, you know, that just doesn't work under the public policy of New Jersey.
Case.
But it's not, I'm limited by my procedural posture. I filed a claim that said they had breached the duty to defend. And my ask of the court, I think well-founded in law and erroneously denied, was make the insurance carrier do that. And one, it might help a little bit to think about this.
Particularly for us, since in the indemnity issue, you're not saying that it's at this stage, I'm not suggesting you wouldn't in a different case, but you're not saying that this is contrary to public policy and unconscionable, and therefore.
To the extent it's being used to deny the duty to defend, I say that.
Okay.
To the extent it's being said, I've always said, though, and it's in the record, no quarrel with the insurance company defending it under a reservation of rights. That's the stand.
We're not talking about indemnity. Okay.
Right.
What is crystallized for us? What is the public policy argument against this provision being used to absolve the insurer of the duty to defend?
Well, it's being, to the extent that it is being used to deny a duty to defend negligence claims and gross negligence claims. It has been the public policy of New Jersey since back to Donick versus Homer that, and recently there are two unpublished opinions, the Ironbound and Estate of Hart versus Singer cases, where this is that the employee tried to get in under a landowner's liability thing, and the insurance company tried to say no, and the courts both said, what are you talking about? It's a claim of negligence in a superior court by an injured employee. Of course you have to defend that. I mean, that is not some arcane or far-reaching position. That's basic stuff. And
is that principle articulated in cases in which the underlying indemnity obligation of the insurer has been specifically disclaimed? Do you see what I'm getting at?
I don't have the case site at the tip of my tongue.
But you see what I'm saying?
There's a very specific quotation that says in those instances, take the typical homeowner situation where the one neighbor has punched the other neighbor in the nose. In that situation, you'll have a plaintiff's attorney alleging that it was a vicious, intentional assault. And oh, by the way, it was also negligent for him to swing his arm. And that's being done specifically to bring the homeowner's policy in. And the case is all recognized. In that instance, there's a duty to defend. The insurance company is not helpless. It can defend under a reservation of rights. It can even bring a Byrd versus Sussex DJ action of its own and try to end that quickly. But the one thing it cannot do is disclaim the duty to defend, because that policyholder has purchased the insurance. And in the workers' comp employer's liability context, it's specifically mandated that it be seamless coverage. And I just asked the court to imagine that this situation, Mr. Revere has an injured employee, very unfortunate situation, and now he needs insurance. And the insurance is gone. That's not seamless coverage. It's the opposite. It's disappearing coverage. And there's no basis under New Jersey law that allows that result.
What happens if there's a duty to defend, there's a motion made under Laidlaw, it's denied. It's found to be within the comp coverage because the intentional wrong exception does not apply, right?
Now the insurer is defending and makes an SJ motion to get out on the workers' comp bar. Is that the hypothetical?
Yeah.
Okay. And does, yes, no, the duty to defend exists, and this is black letter law, until you get rid of all of those claims. And that's one reason why, it's sort of baffling to me motion to make Hartford honor its obligation was denied below, because from a practical standpoint, it's not only contrary to the law that we've cited and the law that I've pounded the table about today, but it's from a practical standpoint just bad judiciating.
And that's the question you have raised your cert petition based on. Is there a duty to defend here?
I'm sorry, Chief Justice.
The issue that is your cert petition is whether there's a duty to defend.
That is absolutely, yeah. You lost me because I'm not here on a cert petition. I'm here on a motion for leave to appeal.
Excuse me.
But yes, the duty to defend is my issue. But I can't look past the fact that it was kind of a double whammy in the trial court for me, because what I said, so I file a third party complaint seeking to require Hartford to honor its duty to defend. Hartford comes back and cites this provision in the employer's liability part of the policy, saying that ends all thing. And I said, well, it doesn't get rid of the negligence claims. It doesn't even apply to the negligence claims on its face. So what are we talking about? But I also say to the lower court, if you're going to accept that argument and say that this employer's liability exclusion somehow negates the obligation to defend the negligence claims, which are within the coverage and scope of the workers' comp thing, then give me a chance to amend my complaint to challenge the public policy of it.
I have a question about that.
I was denied that as well.
When you move to amend to add the claim that the exclusion was void against public policy, were you seeking to assert a claim that would have demanded both indemnification and a defense?
I can only tell you, I hadn't gotten that far because I'm still trying to get my foot in the door.
But I'm confident in saying... Hold on, Mr. Clark. The court would not be entertaining a motion to amend without you telling it what the amendment was. I mean, there must have been a proposed amendment.
Oh, yes, it's in the record.
Were you seeking, and I will tell you, I read it this way, both indemnity and a defense?
Yeah, I think I was challenging indemnity as well, because I think that you will have that case before you sometime in the future.
But that broadens the issue to indemnity, the issue that this court, if you're seeking to have reverse the motion to amend, then indemnity is involved in this case, because you were seeking, you told the court, what I'd like to amend to do is to both seek both indemnity and a defense under the proposed language of your amended complaint, right?
With the qualification that it was all conditional on, if you are not going to hold them to their duty to defend, if you are going to say that this exclusion somehow gets them beyond defending claims of negligence and gross negligence, then I should be allowed to file that action.
So said differently, if you prevail on your first point, the duty to defend, that's the end.
That's it.
Only on the duty to defend negligence and gross negligence claims.
I'm sorry,
correct?
Justice, wait, interrupt.
If you were to prevail on the argument that there is a duty on the part of the insurer to defend against negligence and gross negligence claims, then, as the Chief Justice just said, the case would be over and nothing would remain of you just said that your other argument is only in the alternative, correct?
Yes, correct. And let me just expand on that briefly, because the way things go in my experience is, all right, now they get brought in to defend the case. They have to defend the case. Finally, I'm out of the case again, and Mr. Rivez is being represented by the attorney who should be representing him. Now it goes along. It goes along. Justice Patterson is correct that at some point there may be a motion to get rid of the negligence claims because they are going to be subject to the workers' compensation bar. But here's the thing. Those motions don't get routinely granted, and unless they prevail on it. But if they somehow succeed in doing that, then there may be a next dispute. But it is the next dispute. I'm at the first dispute, and Chief Justice Ravner is correct. I can't seek more than that because that's what I was seeking. I can flag for the court that there's an issue out there ultimately about the consistency with public policy of this provision as a matter of indemnity, because under the logic and language of the Schmidt versus Smith case, it would be against public policy. But I think the way that should get raised is that if either they represent SIR and bring a DJ action, now SIR may have to defend that action on that basis. I don't know.
Is that a standard policy? Has that been a standard provision in comp policies since 2007 when Dobie took a look at it?
The record is undeveloped on that. I'm going to say that I think so, but I do think it's important the way that whole business got slipped into the record. This was not even in the record of the trial
court.
That's
a different issue, but I'm asking you what I'm getting to is the fact that we have now 17 years of this policy being out there, and it doesn't.
If they had been denying defenses on the basis of that exclusion for those 17 years, I submit you know there would have been cases like this one coming to you before now. So it's some kind of change in practice in the insurance industry where I guess they say, well, we have this newfangled and great exclusion, but what good is it doing us? We're still getting roped into the laid low cases or something like that. But you can see I'm hypothesizing.
You referenced Byrd versus Sussex.
Byrd versus Sussex. I'm familiar with it. Yes.
Can you elaborate on its relevance to this case?
Well, as I say, it's not a unique feature of workers' comp cases to have this tension between intentional and non-intentional torts. And so, in my experience and understanding, and it's honestly a long time since I read it, so if I mangle it, apologies. But basically, the holding is you've got to defend, but if you want to say this should not be defended, you can bring your own action. Happens sometimes. I was thinking about this today, and I will say I can't tell you the number of cases in which I've been involved in which carriers have defended under a reservation, and I couldn't tell you how many that is. And I can tell you how many cases the carrier that has reserved defenses has basically ultimately disclaimed coverage. None. It's never happened. And that's the practicality of it. And so I know here we're dealing with pretty academic issues, but you got to look at the practice of it as well, and especially in light of the policy.
Well, your adversary may say we have this is an unusual situation because this part of this complaint was expressly disclaimed coverage. There is an exemption in here and has been for a number of years that says we will not cover this Laidlaw claim. So if what you're saying is if they defend, they're going to end up indemnifying, I'm not so sure.
Well, I don't see how that argument flies, Your Honor, because as long as there is a claim in there that triggers the defense, the fact that there are ones that might fall within an exclusion is immaterial. And that's why the Voorhees rules exist. And I want to say one other thing.
Can I ask you to say it briefly? We're beyond the half hour at this point.
I was trained on a basic principle of the duty to defend is broader than the duty to indemnify. This is still good law in New Jersey. The results that have been reached below are completely irreconcilable with that principle. And it bothers me that if I argued it once, I argued it 12 times getting here, the duty to defend is broader than the duty to indemnify. And not once is that principle mentioned in any of the cases. And the reason is that if you try to think about how you get from point A, where we are, to affirming or doing that, you can't get there if you uphold that principle. And so I'm asking for the basic and well-established principles of insurance law to be applied here. I'd like to say that the record makes clear that Mr. Revev bought a policy that was supposed to provide, and by law was required to provide, seamless coverage for bodily injuries sustained by his employees in workplace accidents. And it was his reasonable expectation that if he gets hailed into court and sued by an injured employee for bodily injuries sustained in the course of a workplace accident, that he would be represented and defended by his insurance company. That did not happen here. And that is not seamless coverage in any meaningful sense of the word. We ask you to uphold his reasonable expectations and rights as a policyholder. It's disappointing that
we have your position.
Yes, I'm sorry. I'll go on if you let me.
We'll have you back for rebuttal, Mr. Meyer.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice, Associate Justices. It's a pleasure to be here. May it please the court. This is, at the end of the day, a simple insurance coverage case. and insurance coverage cases involve the application of specific policy language to the allegations of an underlying complaint. But what has been absent from counsel's discussion and counsel's papers is any reference at all to the actual policy language here. The Hartford issued a two-part policy to SIR. Part one is for workers' compensation. And that part specifically provides when we pay, we will pay promptly when due the benefits required of you by the workers' compensation law. Nothing about negligence, it requires benefits. When we will defend, we have the right and duty to defend at our expense any claim proceeding or suit against you for benefits payable by this insurance. We have no duty to defend a claim proceeding or suit that is not covered by this insurance. This is part one. And this complaint does not seek workers' compensation benefits, so it cannot be covered under part one of the policy. In fact, the original complaint in paragraphs 51 to 55 expressly acknowledged that by the complaint, the plaintiff is seeking workers' comp, is not seeking workers' compensation benefits. Rather, he is seeking damages beyond what can be recovered by the act, under the act. SAR admits on page four of its brief with respect to the original complaint that, quote, SIR's conduct in all of its pled varieties was alleged to have created a substantial certainty of injury to plaintiff. This is significant for two reasons. One, it admits that the underlying complaint is not seeking workers' compensation benefits. And two, it acknowledges that all of the allegations in the complaint taken together is stating a Laidlaw claim. It is stating that there's a substantial certainty of injury to plaintiffs, whether it be negligence, gross negligence, recklessness, whatever. In fact, the trial court recognized that in its ruling on the reconsideration motion. To be sure, plaintiff's complaint sets forth specifically that plaintiff was pleading a Laidlaw claim, regardless of the label, negligence or gross negligence or intentional attached. The specific nature of plaintiff's claim is one advancing specifically and solely a Laidlaw claim, and the employee otherwise has no cause of action against his or her employer for a work-related injury. As such, coverage is barred because there is no claim available to the plaintiff other than a Laidlaw claim. With respect to part two, employer's liability, the exclusion is clear and unambiguous, and it applies to bar coverage for Laidlaw claims. It applies for all intentional acts within the exception of 3415(8) and bodily injury resulting from an act or omission which is substantially certain to result in bodily injury. With respect to the duty to defend under New Jersey law, and this was recognized by the trial court, the duty of an insurer to defend is determined by a side-by-side comparison of the policy and the complaint and is triggered when the comparison demonstrates that if the complaint's allegations were sustained, the insurer would be required to pay the judgment. The trial court relied on Sears Roebuck and Danik versus Homer for that. In fact, Danik versus Homer says a distinction is drawn between a groundless action and one which measured by the pleadings, even if successful, would not be within the policy coverage. This is not a groundless complaint. This is one where if the allegations in the underlying complaint, if successful, could never be covered under this complaint because they allege a Laidlaw claim. Likewise, SIR attempts to make a public policy argument without discussing the actual public policy at issue. Courts of New Jersey and the Appellate Division and Supreme Court and Delta Plastics and Bessler, respectively, weighed in on this very language and the workers' compensation, the legislature through the Workers' Compensation Act delegates the responsibility of coming up with language for workers' compensation policies to the Department of Banking Insurance and the Compensation Rating and Inspection Bureau, CRIB. And based upon the concern that the exclusive remedy might be eroded and the potential for increased costs. I mean, that's a significant public policy concern, that if these kinds of claims, if the court finds insurance for these kinds of claims, that insurance premiums will rise and possibly insurers will leave the state and mid-level and small businesses won't be able to get workers' compensation coverage, which they're required to do by statute. The language was proposed by CRIB, was reviewed, and was approved by the commissioner of the Department of Banking and Insurance and placed into the policies. Additionally, SIR claims that the Workers' Compensation Act sets forth a mandate that Laidlaw claims, those claims which are subject to the exception of 3415-8, must be covered by either Part 1 workers' compensation or Part 2 employer's liability of the policy, but fails to point to exactly where in the statute there is such a mandate, and that's because one doesn't exist. Presumably, going back to Schmidt versus Smith, they are relying on sections 3415-72 and 3415-78. 3415-78 requires insurance for all of the obligations under 3415-72. But 3415-72 only requires, only sets forth the obligations that an employer has under Section 1 of the Act, which is the actions at law section 1 through 6. And this claim does not qualify under Section 1 because, one, workers' compensation benefits are being paid. So there is an election of workers' compensation coverage.
In terms of Section 1, your adversary says that it has always been accepted by insurers in New Jersey throughout time, that there is a duty to defend in cases that allege negligence and gross negligence. Do you disagree with that?
Wholeheartedly, Your Honor. There is no case in New Jersey up until the appellate division in Rodriguez Ortiz where coverage for a negligence claim brought in the superior court was covered under Part 1 of the policy, or the equivalent of Part 1 under the policy, because Danik versus Hammer-Honor goes back 77 years. So Part 1, workers' compensation benefits, and that covers Article 2 under the Act, the election of workers' compensation benefits. Part 2, employer's liability, and that covers.
So again, this is just a dispute about the law, and both sides are saying there's lots of cases, presumably, that say there's no duty to defend in cases of negligence, there is a duty to defend in cases of negligence, or is it just that this has never been litigated before? I'm having trouble understanding what the nature of the dispute is when there's such varying statements of the law has always been X, no, the law has always been not X.
Well, I'm confused as well by counsel's assertion that there is a long-standing abiding obligation for defense of superior court tort claims under Part 1 workers' compensation, because I read the language, and maybe that's the problem. Maybe they haven't read the language. The Part 1 only applies to provide coverage for workers' compensation benefits and only has a duty to defend it claims specifically seeking those workers' compensation benefits.
Correct, but presumably any case for negligence, I think your adversary's point is, any case for negligence, even if it doesn't specifically state we are really only alleging that we are entitled to workers' compensation benefits, is by statute entitled only to workers' compensation benefits. And so the defense itself is just having the case removed and sent to workers' compensation instead of superior court.
I by your statement, I believe that you're acknowledging that the statute itself under 3415, I believe it's 49, gives exclusive jurisdiction to the Workers' Compensation Board for the resolution of those claims. So a negligence claim that exists in a complaint by necessity is just part of a Laidlaw claim. You can, you know,
even though there's no requirement in workers' compensation for the plaintiff to prove negligence, you're saying that that's in essence a comp claim and that would be an easy dismissal or transfer?
Well, counsel admitted here that what has happened is that plaintiffs are alleging negligence, gross negligence, et cetera, in their complaints, even though they know that those can only be can only result in a ruling against the defendant employer
if you're right,
if substantial certainty is proven.
If you're right on that point, let's assume that you are, and those claims are meritless, why don't you still have a duty to defend nonetheless?
Because if they were proven to be true under the duty to defend standards of the state of New Jersey, allegations of a complaint, if proven to be true, are subject to a duty to defend. There is no way that these allegations, if proven to be, can be proven to be true.
Why? So, why can't they be proven to be true in a way that just entitles the person to workman's compensation?
Because workers' compensation is in the exclusive jurisdiction of the workers' compensation board.
But your adversary's point is the person who has to pay the money to get the case from superior court to workers' compensation is the insurer and always has been.
Well, that's not true because this situation has not always existed. He's talking about the other types of not Laidlaw, not exceptions to 3415-8. This is a whole other animal. This is not Schmidt versus Smith. In Schmidt versus Smith, the negligence claim that was at issue was a harassment, sexual harassment claim. There was no
outside of comp.
Sorry?
Which is outside of comp.
Which is outside of comp. And the Schmidt versus Smith came up with the seamless coverage concept because they were referring to 3415-72, which referred back to Article 1. There was no comp paid. And so there was a requirement. And when you talk about seamless comp, it seems to me when we look at the actual rulings and issues in Schmidt versus Smith and Variety Farms, it's an either or situation. The overriding.
Let me ask you, what do you think that seamless means in the context of this case? Does that mean there can be no gaps?
Well, when you talk about gaps, the gap is no coverage. Not that there you can't have coverage under one part and not another. In Schmidt versus Smith, there were no gaps because there was no workers' comp, and so it had to be covered under Article 1, which was covered under Part 2 of the policy. Similarly, in Variety Farms involved a minor who was subject to
child labor,
special circumstances under 3415-10. Interesting enough, in 3415-10, the minor is given the option of either seeking double workers' compensation or having a tort claim. Not both, either or. And it might be determined that he would get more under a tort claim, which is his right as a minor. But also 3415-10 specifically states that double compensation, the extra amount has to be paid by the employer.
Let me ask you something about the enhanced intentional injury exclusion. It says, with respect to exclusion C5, this insurance does not cover any and all intentional wrongs within the exception allowed Section 8 of Workers' Comp Act, including but not limited to, et cetera. When the word cover, what does it mean in that exclusion? Does it mean cover in the sense of if you get hit with a judgment, we will pay that judgment, or does that include defend?
That includes everything. That includes the entire insurance. This insurance does not apply to cover any Laidlaw claims. And of course the purpose
is cover defined in the policy to include both indemnity and defense.
There's no specific definition.
Is it a term of art? And so many things are, yes, in insurance law. So when you see this insurance does not cover, that in the industry denotes we will neither indemnify nor defend?
There's no coverage, period. It's both.
And I just want to, one more question.
Absolutely.
17 years have gone by since this was reviewed by Dobie, and I understand that they were looking for clarity in that review. But in any event, is this a standard policy in comp policies throughout New Jersey?
Well, in New Jersey, a comp insurers can only issue policies that have been approved by CRIP.
Right.
And so to the extent that these are the forms that have been approved by CRIP, these are the only forms that can be used.
Okay. But is this exclusion in virtually every workers' compensation policy? Is it very common?
Your Honor, I cannot.
Then let me ask you, is it widespread or common, this exclusion?
Yeah, I would assume so, because of the exact reason that was given by the committee in CRIB when they submitted this. And that is that the fear was that the opening up of coverage, that the original C5 exclusion, which is in every policy, would not apply because of the substantial certainty standards set forth by Laidlaw, that this would open the door for it would erode the exclusive remedy, but it would open the door,
right,
for premiums.
Yeah, premiums.
And then, you know, not only would premiums go up, which and that's a significant public policy concern.
And I'm not disputing that. My question is this: in 17 years, with obviously thousands and thousands of comp policies out there, and presumably many, if not most, including this exclusion, since it was reviewed in the process you described, has anybody litigated one? Does this disclaim coverage for defense in the Laidlaw situation? And two, whether this provision is unconscionable either as applied to the duty to defend or the duty to indemnify?
The answer to that question is yes, and of course it's the Rodriguez-Ortiz case.
Right.
And the interesting thing about Rodriguez—that's
the only case. Just so I know, is
yes.
That the only case?
Well, there's some coming up, but that sit before you right now. In fact, I believe there is a recent appellate division decision, the Tapia decision.
Is this something to look forward to?
Yeah. Well, maybe not. Which has a 2024 New Jersey super unpublished Lexis 1498. And there are several trial court decisions that I think are being appealed right now.
What's the name of that case again?
Tapia, T-A-P-I-E versus 74 Industries Inc., Velcro USA Inc.
And it's an unpublished APTIV?
An unpublished appellate.
And which way does it go?
It finds that the exclusion is clear, unambiguous, and applies to bar coverage, and it is not against public policy.
I just wanted to go back to the duty to defend again. So I just want to understand what your position is. Again, there's been a lot of discussion about on both sides about what is customary in the industry. So an employee files a complaint alleging negligence in the superior court. It eventually gets transferred to the workers' compensation because that's where it should be. What is your position on whether there's a duty to defend in removing that case to workers' compensation? Does that fall under the part one duty to defend, or is the insurance company completely out of it because there wasn't a specific workers' compensation allegation? I'm just trying to understand whose duty is it to handle that case until it goes, it's transferred to workers' comp?
I would suggest that the premise that these negligence claims need to be defended and dismissed and transferred to workers' comp is not correct.
There would be an attorney in the matter making all of those things happen.
I would suggest that however the complaint is couched, whether it be negligence, gross negligence, recklessness, intentional, specifically mentions Laidlaw like this complaint does, specifically mentions 34 15-8, that is all seeking a Laidlaw claim. And however they're seeking, and counsel has admitted that what you need to prove Laidlaw is in flux, and it's arguable that negligence can result in substantial certainty. When you kitchen sink plead something, you're going to put everything in there. But at the end of the day, because exclusive jurisdiction is given to the Workers' Compensation Board by the Act for workers' compensation claims, this can only be a Laidlaw claim. It can only, and what if it's not a lead locate?
Yeah, but what if it's not a lead?
It has to be if workers' compensation is being paid. If workers' compensation is not-
only a landlord claim could succeed. But Justice Pierre-Louis is asking for a claim that's filed that will not succeed and therefore must be transferred to workman's compensation. Who has to pay to get it transferred?
Right.
Or I know a lawyer standing up to say this has to be transferred.
I disagree that it has to be transferred. There already is a workers' compensation claim.
We're talking about, I know in this case, there's workers' compensation being paid. We're talking about a case where that has not happened.
Oh, well then yes because sorry. Absolutely. Then,
I'm sorry. I should have made that clear. This is a hypothetical.
Okay.
An employee, that's why I'm not saying mentioning names, an employee has filed a suit alleging negligence.
Yes.
What happens? Who okay. is defending?
If, and this is important to the hypothetical, if there has been an opt out to the payment of workers' compensation under 3415-9, which you can do, you can opt out, and there's no workers' compensation being paid, yes, a negligence claim will be covered because 3415-72 will apply because it will be a claim that's brought under Article 1 of the Act. So I'm so sorry for
that is
not understanding.
So that falls under the insurance company's duty to defend under Part 1 at that point.
If there has been election by the employer and the employee to opt out of workers' compensation benefits, because again, that's a trade. You know, there's a trade-off here. The whole purpose of the Workers' Compensation Act is that certainty is given for the payment of workers' compensation benefits for giving up the right to a tort claim in Superior Court. So if your hypothetical assumes that election for no workers' compensation benefits has been made, then yes, that's something that's covered under Article 1, and there's coverage under Part 2. That's exactly, but in the absence of that, if there's a workers' compensation claim, the only other claim that can be had by that employee is the opt-out of 34 or the intentional acts claim under 3415-8, and that is outside of the act.
So the employer is left with no counsel. Let's say there's negligence, gross negligence, and a Laidlaw claim, right? You've already talked about what happens with that Laidlaw claim, but there's no duty to defend an ambiguous and probably improperly pled negligence or gross negligence claim? Or are you saying that because of uncertainty as to what Laidlaw means, you're assuming that it's all under gross negligence and negligence are under Laidlaw?
It can't be anything else because of 3415-8.
It can't be anything else to win, but doesn't someone have to argue it can't be anything else? Doesn't someone have to submit the papers to the Superior Court that says the only claim that can possibly survive is a Laidlaw claim, so everything else that's alleging negligence has to be dismissed?
I mean, that's part of, those allegations cannot be proven to provide coverage under the employer's liability section of the policy. It's not covered.
But what about the duty to defend language? Can let an insured know that? Where you focused on the benefits language, but any claim, proceeding, or suit against you. Why should we read that language as solely residing in workers' comp?
Are you talking about?
In part one,
because it goes on to say, we have the right and duty to defend at our expense a proceeding, any suit against you for benefits. They're already getting benefits, and this common law action is not seeking benefits. It's alleging negligence, but that's not seeking benefits. You can again allege negligence as part of your Laidlaw claim to prove substantial certainty.
Mr. Clark argued earlier that Hartford's position in this case is an outlier by not providing a duty to defend. Do you disagree?
I do. If there's no coverage for it. Again, we're providing workers' compensation benefits, and this particular complaint, and I will add, this particular complaint is on its face, might be different than some of the other complaints because it does specifically in paragraphs 51 to 55 and expressly allege a Laidlaw claim. It says it. It says we are seeking damages beyond what can be offered by the Workers' Compensation Act.
But it also asserts recklessness and negligence claims. Is it your understanding of the industry that Hartford's position and not providing a duty to defend in those instances is the norm for other companies?
That is my understanding. I cannot speak to everyone, but that is my understanding. And again, if I may, the reason for this is if this coverage is if this is held to be coverage, and counsel already spoke about this, there are allegations being made just to invoke the coverage when coverage shouldn't exist to get money.
You agree with Mr. Clark that what is going on out there is that negligence and gross negligence claims, perhaps recklessness as well, which don't have Laidlaw language in them, are being made so that there will be a defense and maybe some insurance money if the case settles?
One can surmise that. That's not the situation here. Again, this complaint specifically makes a Laidlaw claim. But again, the fear was that this will increase premiums. Insurers will stop writing. Insurance won't be available. There is always a weighing with public policy. And I would submit that a huge public policy argument here is to dissuade illegitimate Laidlaw claims. I mean, no one wants to prevent a legitimate situation. But again, we don't want insurance to promote bad behavior by employers. If coverage is going to be provided for anything that might be a Laidlaw claim, then there, and I believe that Laidlaw specifically talked about this fear, that you don't want to encourage employers to be bad actors because their bad acts are going to be covered by insurance. But again, that increases the premiums. The insurance industry is already on record with the CRIB and the DOB that premiums are going to go up if this coverage is there, and just sort of opens the door to illegitimate claims.
Have any carriers, to your knowledge, decided what the heck, we won't include the exemption, we'll cover the Laidlaw claim, and we will charge more for the premiums? Charge a bigger premium?
That is not something that I know. I would suggest that wouldn't be the first option. That the
high risk option.
Yeah, I would suggest that if insurance is not available, illegitimate Laidlaw claims will go away, and then we'll be back into an equilibrium where workers' compensation, and again, we're talking about like double dipping here. You know, we're paying the workers' compensation benefits. If intentional damages were being awarded, they wouldn't be covered anyway. But if something else were being awarded, that would be a double recovery for negligence, and we don't want to be encouraging that either.
And you say that because you have the exemption language in your policy that keeps the Laidlaw out of the case.
That keeps it out. And again, you know, this court in Bessler and the appellate division in Delta Plastics suggested that language. They had the opportunity there to say that a C5 exclusion, that an intentional exclusion, was against public policy. And they didn't. They just disagreed that the language of C5 was broad enough to preclude coverage for the developments that happened with Laidlaw, the substantial certainty standard that came about. They didn't say full out, you can't do this. And in fact, there are exclusions for intentional acts in all sorts of coverages which apply and are not against public policy, even in the auto, which is also heavily regulated.
One last question.
Thank you.
I promise this time. I think I did that before, didn't I, Chief? You have one unpublished opinion finding this to be against public policy, finding the exemption to be against published. Both unpublished opinions.
There's no opinion at all that has found it to be against public policy.
So there's zero law on
it. No. In fact, Rodriguez-Ortiz suggested after reviewing Schmidt versus Smith, which I just explained was inapplicable because of 3415-72, they suggested that it could be for another day, it could be against public policy, but not with respect to the duty to defend, because what the Workers' Compensation Act is meant to protect are the employees.
It's actually going to the futility issue. Just trying to get the overall picture in New Jersey is there is no case anywhere that you're aware of. Obviously, published, we would be aware of. Unpublished, no.
No trial court opinion, no unpublished appellate level division opinion, no. And if the closest is the Rodriguez-Ortiz opinion, which again, from a perspective of the duty to defend, the court said, we're not even going to entertain that this could be against public policy, because what we're talking about is coverage for the insured, the employer, and the Workers' Compensation Act is meant to protect the employee, not the employer.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add?
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Clark, 5 minutes for comment.
Very briefly, I think something important was said by opposing counsel, and that is, I tried to write it down. She said, it's arguable under the current state of the law that negligence can result in substantial certainty. And what that was an acknowledgement of is that we don't know the boundaries of Laidlaw liability. And the reason that's important is that under basic insurance principles, it is the obligation of the insurance company to defend the insured until we have the answer to that question. When multiple alternative causes of action are set forth, the duty to defend will continue until every covered claim is eliminated. Now, there was a very noble attempt to suggest that negligence claims are not covered anywhere in the supposedly seamless coverage of the workers' comp employer's liability policy. And I want to just comment briefly. I'm fine with the Rodriguez-Ortiz analysis that says the duty to defend exists under the workers' comp. But I've always made clear, and I would make clear, I disagree that there's not also a duty to defend under the employer's liability. And I hearken back to, if you look at the Variety Farms case, basically the court wasn't too concerned about which part of the policy it came from. The duty to defend existed there. But keep in mind, traditionally, the employer's liability part of the policy is viewed as covering the superior court actions. No way, no how can the enhanced exclusion be read to negate a duty to defend claims of negligence. And counsel just said, it's possible, we don't know, that claims of negligence could result in Laidlaw liability. This goes back, Your Honor, to why I was trying to mince words about where we are in this. It's not known. But the point is that there are negligence claims in the complaint. We all, I think, agree on that now. There are, we know on the easy case that if you don't defend the negligence claim in a superior court action, there will be a whopping judgment against the employer, justly so. And who is supposed to defend that? It's clearly the insurance company. That's the easy case. But now we have negligence plus Laidlaw.
There is
a duty to defend there.
Can you cite us some of the easy cases? Because it seemed like your adversary was saying, no, there has never been such a case.
I guess
counsel is wrong when he says that this has always been the law.
Well, you can go Ironbound, the two very recent Ironbound and Estate of Singer, those are both negligence claims.
Can you say the cases one more time?
Did you say Ironbound?
Ion-bound.
I would have really misspelled it.
Iron-bound? Ion-bound?
Ion, I think.
A state of heart is PA-141. Ion-bound is PA-148.
Wait, I'm sorry. PA-141 and PA-148?
Right. And those both involve the attempt to get around the comp bar by using a landowner's liability theory.
Are either one of them about a duty to defend a negligence claim in a workman's compensation setting?
Yes. They both are exactly that, and they both say there's a duty to defend.
So the situation in those cases is not a Laidlaw comp bar, but it's not the intentional tort exception. It is going after them on a landowner's liability.
Yes, there are other efforts being made to vault the exclusivity bar of the comp claim, and in both cases the. A duty to defend and the coverage was found to exist. But again, it's hard for me to, I can't cite chapter and verse. I can say practicing in the trial courts for 40 years, when there's a negligence claim against an employer arising out of a workplace accident, the attorney sitting in the next seat has always been assigned attorney by the
and is that carrier. Always the case when there's already workers' comp being paid?
I don't know. I can't tell you because that is, I mean, it's really a non-factor. So they honor their duty to pay workers' comp benefits that doesn't absolve them of the duty to defend a lawsuit. Have I ever been in that situation? I don't know.
Under part one, your adversary is arguing part one is, of course, just workers' compensation.
And it's important
is just workers' compensation insurance. So if there's already workers' compensation being paid, and that's for all purposes been settled, if an employee now files a negligence claim that is really encompassed in workers' compensation, is that a scenario where the insurance company comes in again to defend when they've already handled that portion?
Yeah, if they're
handled that portion of
my answer is if there are negligence claims in that complaint, yes, the insurance company has to come in and do that. And I thank you just very briefly to comment on that, because my adversary's position is that it doesn't come within the scope of the workers' comp insurance coverage unless they're seeking workers' compensation. And that's not the analysis that should govern. It's a question of whether the risk is covered. And consider, if I continue my run of losses in this case, and we're thrown back to the trial court and have to try this case, we're going to have a jury ultimately answering the question of whether or not the substantial certainty plus context test is met. And I pose utter confidence in our justice system that the answer to that is going to be no. And then we will all know.
There won't be a summary judgment motion in this case.
On the context, I think it's possible, but no such thing as a slam dunk summary judgment. I'm sorry, Justice Noriega, may I just finish the point I was trying to make, which is if the jury comes back saying you haven't met the Laidlaw standards, we will know to an absolute certainty that the claim fell within the workers' comp coverage of the policy and only under that. And the answer will have come back from our judicial system, but you don't have insurance for that. That's paradoxical and it's wrong, Your Honor.
Do you disagree with your adversary's position that under part one, any claim proceeding or suit against you is limited by the four benefits language, which is different and very specific to workers' comp?
It's absolutely true that the benefits that you can, that the schedule of benefits under the comp policy are what you get. And that's why people try to escape them. But I do not agree that A duty to defend exists under that part of the policy only if they expressly seek workers' compensation benefits. It's a question of, is the risk covered by that? And if, as long as it's a negligence scenario, it's a risk that's supposed to be and is covered, and under Rodriguez-Ortiz is covered by the workers' comp. But I do want to say as well, I disagree that that duty does not also exist and spring from the employer's liability. I believe the duty to defend negligence claims springs from both, because, you know, Justice Patterson was reading the exclusion. It says it does not cover any and all intentional wrongs. Well, this is not, negligence is not an intentional wrong. My adversary just admitted that, well, we may be in a world where something less than intentional wrongs.
Well, there's more to it. It says intentional wrongs within the exception.
Yeah. It goes on. Well, and by the way, just as an English major, I'm going to tell this court that to say that a policy does not cover any and all intentional wrongs, by the way, is ambiguous, because it logically and linguistically actually means it does cover some. It's the weakest of my arguments. I'm not asking the court to go there, but having heard the language, I couldn't resist pointing out to say does not cover any and all logically means it does cover some. And that's a very easy way to get rid of this case as well.
Thank you, counsel.
Appreciate the time.
Thank you to both counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement.